Did you say Utes?
Okay.
Paramedically sick. Well, come on, man.
It'd be that way.
All right.
Oh, here's one for you, Joe. When does an old idea turn old?
Ooh.
I've got some new old ideas, so I don't know. Let's talk about that for a minute. Old ideas. See, when I think about old ideas, I think about things that don't work anymore. And let me talk about just old ideas generally. So before I got sober, 1977, when I went to college, I took a computer science class. And the computer back then, there's a room about this big, and it would take about a wall and a half, two walls. And you had to do these punch cards. You guys remember a punch? So you did these punch cards, right? And you put them in the card reader. And if you did it right, way on the other side down there, it would print out. Remember that trifold paper? Print out the program. So if I got hit in the head in 1978 and got put in a coma, and in 2024, I come to. I left mine in my room, so I'll use yours. And if I get hit in the head, I wake up in 2024, somebody says, here's your computer, because that's what that is, right? It's a computer. So my first question would be, where's the card reader? Right? Because that's how I know computers. It's card reader. So that's an old idea. So if whatever I've had in the material world, because in the book it says, for now we have entered the world of the Spirit. Well, now we're part of the fellowship of the Spirit. So if I try to use ideas that I've had from the past in the spiritual world, they may not work. They've become old ideas. If they don't work in the spiritual world, they've become old ideas. So what does that look like for people like us? Men don't cry. There's a good old idea. I remember first time I'm sitting at an AA meeting, and a guy starts crying, I get really uncomfortable, because men don't cry. Men don't cry. Now, we know that's not true today. I'll cry at the drop of a hat, right? You start talking about God and spiritual stuff, I get involved. So those things that we have had in the past that we bring to the spiritual world that don't work for us anymore, they're old ideas. Those things are what keep us stagnant from moving forward. Those are the things, what we call sometimes principles. Principles is another word for an old idea. It's something that I'm trying to bring. Prejudices, that's another word for an old idea. That I've tried to bring from the material world to the spiritual world, and they don't work anymore. So I would say that old ideas become old the minute they have no more application in a spiritual life. The second they don't have application here. And the crazy part about that is you might still be trying to use old ideas in the spiritual world, and as long as you're getting something out of it, they'll work. The trouble is when they begin to cause other people enough pain or you enough pain, then you're ready to let go. When we talk about step six today, we just kind of brushed over that. But one of the biggest things in step six that I think people kind of gloss over, it talks about willingness. The step talks about willingness. But in that paragraph, right buried right in the middle of it, it says that we find objectionable. Until I find an old ideal objectionable, it's not an old idea. Or it's at least not one that I'm willing to let go of yet. And drinking was an old idea. And it became objectionable only when I couldn't go any further. Only when I couldn't. So when does an old idea turn to be an old idea? When it no longer works. If you're still getting something out of it, it's probably still a good idea for you. And the moment it stops and starts causing you pain, it's probably an old idea. What do you think? Enough about me. What do you think about me?
Watch this, grasshopper.
Snatch this pebble from my head.
When you live in the moment, every idea is an old idea.
Oh, that's good stuff. Yeah, that's good stuff.
Oh.
Snatch a pebble.
You could have just said that. We'd be on question three now.
Well, you wanted to go first.
Yeah, I did. My dumb ass.
Oh, it's even addressed to you.
What does it say, dumbass? It
says Cliff.
Oh.
With one F. This
very
is
good.
Good, huh?
Yeah.
You made his day, whoever wrote this. What happened to the guy whose wife?
Who froze to death?
Whose wife's port, spot, who, wow, can you read that?
I don't know. Let me see if I can read Chinese. What happened to the guy whose wife, oh, who chose church? The guy who,
oh.
What happened to the guy who, his wife's sponsor said,
yeah,
we need to go to church. I guess he's in church. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I never saw him again. Maybe that worked for him, right? I don't.
That happens a lot.
That happens.
It happens a lot.
Yeah. I don't know.
And I'm okay with it. You know, it's like sometimes people will shame them for that. I go, we know only a little.
This is just a way.
Yeah.
It's a way.
Yeah.
How often did Bill do LSD, and did it help him? You know this answer.
It was more that Lois is the one that really did the LSD. Bill was like, Lois, try this, will you?
See what happens to you.
See, we might spice up our life a little bit.
That's right.
But I don't know the actual answer to that. I mean, it's really it was an experiment. You know, it was it Leahy? Was that the guy that?
Guy from Canada, right?
Yeah, whoever. Yeah, I don't know the actual.
I don't
know
how
many times.
I've had brief conversations with Jay about it. He knows.
Yeah, he's
knows, writing a
yeah.
book. There's a guy writing a book about all this.
You know, and Bill was also into Ouija boards. Bill was a weird character, you know, but he was willing to experiment.
Well, that's and that, you know, we talked about this really. His vision for AA was a lot bigger than just us.
Yeah.
I mean, he saw Alcoholics Anonymous as a way of life because, you know, it talks in there, and I think it's in the preface or the foreword, the first edition, how this way of life has benefits for all. I mean, his vision was that Alcoholics Anonymous, the principles of it could be applied to just regular folks and they could have this. He saw it as a really big movement. Jay's going to talk about that in his book that he's writing. So all those questions, more will be revealed later.
Yeah. I'd be more concerned with the niacin. Bill overdosed himself with niacin. So I'm red all the time, but Bill was the niacin just went to his extremities. It was just he was trying to figure niacin will work, you know. Alcoholics, you give us an idea, we'll go all the way out with it. You know, it's like
we'll run with it.
It's crazy. So that wasn't much of an answer for you, so that's the best we're gonna get from you. Talk about spiritual experience one, transformation from insane to sanity. So there's two. Talk about spiritual experience and the transformation from insane to sanity. Wow. I think they're when you look at it, they're both, for me, they're the same thing. Because it's like, you know, what is insane and what is sanity? You know, it's this soundness of mind. It's this you know, we're not locked up insane. It's that perception, the way we react to things. And it's really because I think that I am God or that you are not God, and I don't have to have any sort of spiritual, you know, my first real spiritual experience came when when I first got sober, I was really, really trying to get into meditation. And we all, you know, it's like you get scared about it. You think you got to get in the lotus position. You got to have a saffron robe. You have all this stuff and incense, and you don't. You know, I talked about Bill just counting the cracks. But I went to a weekend retreat, and there was an Indian guru. He was actually talking, and I thought I'm going to get something really, really new, right? The new idea. And I get there, and he goes, we are going to practice meditation with the St. Francis prayer. And I'm going, you're an Indian. You know? and he said, it's absolutely almost perfection, the St. Francis prayer. But before he said that, he said, I wanted to tell you that because a lot of people have these old ideas, and some of these words are my own, about religion. And he said, if you can make amends to the church of your childhood, you will have a new spiritual experience today. And I was like, wow. And I was born and raised Catholic, and the way I figured to make amends to the church was go to confession. So I got out of that retreat, and I went to confession. And, you know, they have the, you don't see the guy on the other side. And I'm talking to him. And I had this vision that he's probably a drunk, you know. And I came in and I said, I'm in a 12-step program and I want to make amends to the church. And he was, what's this all about? You know, I said, I just need to make amends for my perception of what I need about what the church is. And he said, well, okay, whatever. And say three Hail Marys and Our Father and get out of here. And my spiritual experience started when I released that. If you look in the big book, there's a lot of stuff about release and letting go. And that happened to me, and I think that's what started the transformational process. If you were to go, God, my mind is just shot all of a sudden. If you were to go out to the Grand Canyon on a beautiful sunny day and just stand there for an hour, 2 hours, and watch the transformation, the color hue transformation that happens when that sun rises and it hits the canyon, it is absolutely miraculous. And it happens every single day. And people go out there, they get out of their car, they grab this, they go to the edge, they take a picture, and they go get something to eat.
Yeah.
And I go, stand there and just watch what happens. It's a transformation, and it takes
T-I-M-E.
That's what we don't want. We want it now. And I think that's what the spiritual experience for me is and continues. It's not something I get, I won, and I'm done. It is like, whoa, it's going to happen again.
Experience is plural. Plural.
Shoot on it.
Let me see that question. Yeah. I think this insane to sane transformation kind of deal as it relates to alcohol, that's that process where I'm 60, 90 days, I don't even realize it. Bill talked about that white light experience that just kind of bam, it happened. I think it happens to us. For a guy like me, if you're the educational variety, it happens subtly and profound because we got sober dates, but it doesn't seem that way. It doesn't seem that way for me because I can't catch up with it. Transformation, and in the appendix it talks about this, that the person who's having it, people around him recognize it before they recognize it themselves.
Yeah, you don't even know.
I don't even know. I don't even know I've had it, this profound alteration. So I'm 3 months sober. I'm headed to my meeting. Guy cuts me off in traffic. I chase him for 5 miles, you know. And I think, oh, crap, I'm going to AA. I got to get off here. You know? 6 months later, same guy cuts me off. I just chase him 2 miles. A year on my 1 year anniversary, he cuts me off. I wave at him with all five fingers and just get off. That's transformation. I mean, it just happens, and I just... The edges get smoothed out of me. Sometimes I don't even know that the edges smooth out of my life, that I don't have to chase that. I just find that I've just got to get off, I got to wave and go on. It's not that big a deal. How big a deal is it? If you're in the moment, it's a new idea. So anyway. I love that question.
Oh.
Spiritual questions never begin with why, but this one is, why me? Why not you? Right? Why not you? Why not me? Because this is, a lot of people have these different ways that they get to God. For me, we talk about why me, why not? Because I think this is the only way God could get my attention. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm not that smart. I haven't tried to figure that out yet. But most spiritual questions don't begin with why. I'm convinced of that. It's just me. This is just what is. This is who I am. But I know this is that without becoming alcoholic, I never would have the life I have today. You know? There's a story in the back of the book that talks about that. It talks about the question kept saying, why? I said, well, I don't know why. Who knows why? The mind, I don't know the mind of God. I don't know why us. I don't know why we're all here this week. I don't know why we became alcoholic, crushed by a self-imposed crisis. I think it's the only way God can get to us. I have this idea that if something's defective with my car, and you guys may have had this and over your lifetime, you get a notice in the mail, we're having a manufacturer's recall. a manufacturer's recall. So if I got a problem with my car and the dealership can't fix it, what do? I go back to the manufacturer. I think that's how it is for us. I got a defect. Who do I go back to? The dealers, mom and dad, fix me. They can't fix me. So what I have to do, I got to go to the manufacturer. It's the only place I can go to get this. It's under warranty there. I take it back to the manufacturer. The manufacturer, he gives me a daily reprieve. I get fixed today. I don't get fixed forever, but one day at a time, I'm fixed for that day. I get a reprieve, a stay of execution. That's what reprieve means. You know, it talks about this daily reprieve. I get this stay of execution today. If I return to the manufacturer and say, hey, I'm bringing this back. I'm still screwed up. Can you help me today? Yeah, I can do that today. I can help you today. So why not me?
Yeah, because I think, why not? Why me? If you question that, if I was to question that, then my sponsor would say, so I want you to read the big book in the first person in the present tense. You know, no matter how far down the scale I have gone, I'll see how my experience can benefit someone else. Why me? It's my experience, that identification process. You're not going to identify with everybody, but one other person, wherever you are, probably needs to hear your experience. Your opinion will keep people out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Your experience will bring them all back in. And it's just, for me, it's just, it's, and this is, I think the longer I'm sober, the more I dig in. I am a nerd when it comes to AA literature. And I have taken the 12th step in the 12 and 12 and rewritten the whole thing in the first person in the present tense. And when I read it out loud, I swear to God, it's not only my story, it's Bill's actual story of recovery from a seemingly hopeless state. The why me? It's like, wow, why not me is like the greatest question. You know, there was years ago, there was always the college professor who was a professor of philosophy had a huge class in Harvard, and he had a final exam, and the question was, why? 99% of the room went into this long page, blue book page of why? And the person who got the A said, why not? He closed the book and he turned it in, and that's all he wanted. And that's all the, you know, that's why, yeah.
Why not?
Oh, sorry.
Sir?
Sorry. We got a green sticker.
All right.
We got a green one. Besides all the usual methods, how do you keep the happy, joyous, free attitude? Wow, what a great question. Mm. How do you keep the happy, I love the way that's written, keep the happy, joyous, and free. It's given to me, the happy, joyous, and free.
Three.
So we can't give that away. So you don't really keep it. You know, it's there. It's kind of, that's why Bill talks about the foundation. If the foundation was to collapse, the whole thing would collapse. We're building a strong foundation and an arch through which we can walk through it, a free man. And if you're happy, joyous, and free, that's the classic. You remember the old movie Braveheart? Mm-hmm. And Richard, what was his name?
Not Richard, whatever the guy.
You know, but the guy that the kid that played it, the almost the last scene in the movie was when he could not give up. He would not let go. If you watch that whole movie, everything he was holding on to his wife's, whatever that was, tissue the whole time, and he couldn't let it go until they cut his head off, and that whole scene went poof. He let go, and it fell to the ground. And I go, that's sometimes that we cling to this idea that something else has got to be better than what I have. But the happy, joyous, Bill says, we absolutely insist on being happy, joyous, and free. We insist upon it. It's like, wow, really? You know, when you walk into some meetings and it's like my friend Diana, who works in GSO, she used to live in San Diego. She goes, I've been to an awful lot of AB meetings in my, she's almost 45 years sober. And everybody goes, what the hell is an AB meeting? She says, I don't know, but it's just not an AA meeting. They're talking about everything but recovery from the scene. They're not talking about happy. They're talking about sad and miserable. And then if you lead a meeting and you pick on the three newcomers in the room, it is going to be a meeting that you want to slice everybody's wrist, not only your own. You want to slice your own first and then slice everybody else's. But when you pick on the people that are just living a life that's positive and full of joy, poof. That's how you keep it. You give it away. The paradox in AA is baffling to people that come in here. What do you mean you got to give it all away? I give it all away.
Gone prospector.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. And if you don't, you're going to sit there, and then all of a sudden that happy, joyous, and free feeling is just not in your soul. I'm not going to that meeting again. Those people are too positive.
Those happy people.
Yeah, go ahead.
I like that part of the book about the gaunt prospector so much I'm going to read it. But you mentioned it because I love that. Because that is the deal, right? That's the great paradox here, that we got to give it away to keep it. But that's what did Dr. Bob say? You said this week, keep it. We don't screw this. Let's don't louse this thing
up.
Don't
louse it up.
Is he not so unbalanced as they may think? Many of us have experienced dad's elation. We have indulged in spiritual intoxication like a gaunt prospector. Belt drawn in over the last ounce of food. Our pick struck gold. Joy at our release from a lifetime of frustration knew no bounds. Father feels he has struck something better than gold. For a time, he may try to hug the new treasure to himself. He may not see at once that he has barely scratched a limitless load, which will pay dividends only if he mines it for the rest of his life and insists on giving away the entire product. That's what we do. Now, how do you stay happy, joyous, and free? You mine it for the rest of your life and insist on giving it all away.
Yeah. What's his name? Johnny Harris used to say, you'll find it when you come in here as a taker. And that whole transformation process to the happy, joyous, and free is when you become a giver. And just give it all. Just give, and expect nothing in return.
Look, this one's for me. It's got my name on it. Look at that.
But it's got two F's, though.
Well, no, it's not really for me. Cliff with two F's. Having had a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, how do we have more? Oh, that's a great question. And we're going to talk about this the next
time. I love how it's all building on it.
Yeah. We're headed this way. So the question we all have to ask ourselves, if you look back at the time you got sober, when you completed the 12 steps and you had the inkling, I'm having this awakening, if you're at 5, 7, 10, 40, could I have stayed sober that long on the experience I had way back there? Could I have stayed sober on that experience? And I think the answer is no. Because if I just stop growing, if I stop spiritual growth right there, I start to backtrack through the steps. I get to that spot. Is this it? Because that's what happens to a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. So they come to AA and they just stop. And most people, I think, they go through and they stop. And then they try to live on the work they did on 1 through 9. Okay. Oh, I'll pray. I'll help somebody. I'll go somewhere. I'll see if I have to. If somebody shows up at my meeting, I'll talk to them. So I'm really existing on 1 through 9. I've had an experience, but I'm existing on 1 through 9. And so they rock along and they have a good time in the fellowship. But somewhere about year 5, year 6, they look up and they think, is this it? And they call on George, and you know what George is going to say. Says the same damn thing he says every time here on Friday night. Says the same thing. And they go around the room, and so you know what everybody's going to say. And the next time it comes time for your home group, you're thinking, you know, I know what they're going to say. I'm not going to go tonight. I'm going to switch over to that other meeting on the other side of town. And you go over there, and they're saying the same thing, maybe just a little different. And you start listening to them, and they're just saying the same stuff over there. And I know what they're going to say. And so you just quit going. People just stop going. Because you know what they're going to say. I know it. And so all spiritual growth has ceased, period. And I believe you're either moving forward here or you're sliding backwards. And so what happens to those people? What happens to them? Everybody in this room that's got any kind of time can tell stories about people. Came to AA, they knew them, came in with people, and they stuck around here, and then suddenly they just disappeared. And you call them and say, hey, what are you doing? I'm not going to the meeting tonight. I'm doing this. And they just slowly withdrew from AA. And you don't know what happened to them. Who knows? Your phone died. You got a new phone. You don't have their number anymore. And they're not around. You don't even think about them anymore. Where did they go? What happened to them? And then you read about them. Or you hear about them. Hey, did you hear what happened to Bobby? Man, he was driving the road, and he crossed center line. He's drunk. Hit a family of four. It's tragic. That's what happens to us, you know. Or they just go live their lives in quiet desperation. And that's not a life, that's an existence. I could be sober today, go home and just say, you know, I'm quitting AA, but I'm not going to drink, and I could just not drink and stay home. I'm just not drinking. And I'm a guy that believes, I'm honest with you, that a real alcoholic, as described by this book, can just not drink and go to meetings if two conditions exist. Nothing good ever thing happens to him, or nothing bad ever happens to him. If those two conditions can exist, nothing good or nothing bad ever happens to the alcoholic, they can just not drink and go to meetings. But we know that's not life, because alcoholics will find something wrong with everything. And they never find the good in stuff. If you have a bad day, it's going to be this way forever. It's going to be this way forever. You ever had a good day and think, it's going to be this way forever? Never have that thought. Only bad days do we think it's going to be this way forever. So, you know, I think I count on experiences, because it's the nature of, what do we saw? Spiritual growth. If I'm having spiritual growth, I'm having ongoing spiritual experiences. And to get those is back to what Joe said. I keep trying to love and serve. I keep trying to give it away. And it's in that, it's in the doing, it's in the action that I continue to have those experiences. I can read wordy books until I go out and put it in practical application. I'm just reading books. I can read a book on how to play tennis until I go buy a racket, get some balls, make a reservation, and go to a tennis court where somebody else is playing. I'm not playing tennis. I'm just thinking about it. I'm studying about it. It's a dream. But until I take action, when I start taking action, then I get all the good stuff.
What do you think?
I love that. It wasn't addressed to me, but that's quite. It's about the spiritual experience. When I was about 2 years sober, I was on fire. I'm still on fire. I love being sober. I love being in AA. But I'm in San Diego, and I decided to go home for the holidays back to Boston. And I go to a meeting in the town where my mother was, and they called on me. The guy from California, you want to share? I said, sure. So I just was on fire, talking about the steps and God and love and all this crap, right? And I was thrilled that I was able to bring this message to these people that needed to hear what I had to say. Then they called on the next guy, and he goes, you goddamn Californians, all you do is talk about God and the steps. I was hurt. For 20 years, I was hurt. I hated every meeting in Boston. I hated every meeting east of the Mississippi River. I hated everybody. Everybody. It was just unbelievable how I held on to that. It was just, I would go back and every meeting was awful. They're awful. And I'll never forget, I was back there for work once, and they had a hurricane in Boston. All the lights were out, and there was only one restaurant open, and it was a Sunday night, and I was miserable. And I'm walking back to my hotel, and I'm calling my sponsor walking down the road, and he goes, it sounds like you need a meeting. I said, you know what I think about these meetings here and this. I hate everybody, blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. He said, Jesus, you got to find one. I don't know where they're at. The lights are out. We can't find anything. And I'm walking by this church, and there's three people out front with styrofoam cups in their hand. And I go, is there a meeting going on? 5 minutes upstairs. I went, Ken, there's a meeting going. Get up there. And I go in, and there's this heavyset girl at the table like this, and she's going to tell her story. They do the 20-minute share and then a discussion. I'm going, oh, there's nothing this woman's going to say. I can't. I'm looking around. I go, this isn't going to work for me. And she started telling her story, and she started talking about God and the steps. And I'm sitting there, and there's a guy, a little goombay, sitting there. He's got greased black hair, and it's just slicked back, and he's got T-shirt under a tank top, and he's got arms like this, and he's just tattooed, and he's smiling. I'm going, what has happened here? And I'm going, this is incredible. And I shared that story about, you know, what had happened to me. And the guy with the tattoos, he says, you've been holding that crap for 20 years. He goes, what's that all about? I was missing the experience because I had an old idea. I had a resentment, and I didn't want to get rid of it. It gave me a feeling of superiority. In the seventh step, it talks about a feeling of superiority. I was neglecting the experience of what those people have to give me. And it was like unbelievable what happened when I, and now every time I go back, I bring people to this one meeting. It's called Out from the Basement, too. And it's on Newbury Street, which is a really posh neighborhood in Boston. But it's just this, just the city kids and just, and it's just, you're Contempt prior to investigation, I read it earlier, will keep me in everlasting ignorance. That doesn't mean I'm insane. It doesn't mean I'm stupid. It means that I'm holding on to something that I don't want to let go of. And when you do that, away we go.
I had a follow-up with that because you reminded me. Because I was going to talk about it earlier. We ran out of time, then I forgot because I'm old. But in the spiritual experience, so it says this. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials for recovery. So willingness, honesty, open-mindedness. So how many times have we heard people say, well, it's honesty, open-minded, and willingness? How? How?
Yeah.
Well, let's think about it. Let's see what the book says. It says who? Yeah. Willingness, honesty, open-minded. So if we go by their acronym that says how, so they're saying, well, I'll just get honest first. How many people got honest first here? How many just people got just open second? No. Willingness. Willingness comes first. I can't come here and get honest. I can't come here with mine. I got to be willing to be those things. Then I might be willing to be a little honest with you. And then I can get open-minded about things. I hear that all the time. People say it's how. And they misquote the book.
Yeah. A lot.
And you think, well, why is that a big deal? Because it's the order is important. So it's not how, it's who. And I think it's also important that it's who. Who?
It's the wise owl.
It's the wise owl. How many licks? I don't know. So, but who? But doesn't that tie into the power, right? Three things. You notice that? Three things. But it's who rather than how. Who? The power. It's the power that gives me this. It's the power that allows me to have the experience. I don't think that's not lost on me. Who? Who?
Oh. Who was Bill's sponsor?
Which one?
Well, see, that's a great question.
Yeah.
That's a great question. At first, it would have been Ebby. I mean, and Bill, to his dying day, said Ebby was his sponsor.
Yep.
Ebby was his sponsor. But what happened along the way was Bill realized that, you think about it, you know, Ebby had a problem with alcohol.
What?
And he ended up dying sober, you know, but he ended up dying sober down in Texas, and he left the New England area. But Bill would always turn to somebody. And I think if Bill was here today, I don't know, the more I read about him, I think he would probably really, really say that Shoemaker and Ed Dowling were probably the people that were his foundation for security.
Non-alcoholics.
Catholic priest and a Lutheran minister.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if
yeah.
We think about that. And think about that you know, when we come in here, we most of the time, especially new people, they badmouth the hell out of their church. Badmouth whatever church they're in. And then the old timer in the back of the room, he goes, you know, you're sitting in a church basement, right? Said, they are not resentful at us.
True.
And it's really, really true. So who was Bill's? Bill was really, he realized that he had to, and if you look at his experience when he set up the foundation, he realized that alcoholics are not good with money, so therefore we need some financial people. They're not good with medicine, so therefore we need some medical people. They're not good with reading or writing, and so we need some literature people. They're not good with a lot of technical stuff, so he loaded the GSO, or he loaded the foundation first with people that had, what, experience, and how their experience were going to be benefiting Alcoholics Anonymous. So you look at how he looked at that whole sponsorship thing. It's like, really, this is what his leadership and his vision for Alcoholics Anonymous and for his own life was, you know. And yet he was still struggled with his demons. He struggled with them. And I think he probably really, really confided in with Ed Dowling, because he was the guy that came into him and said, Bill, what can I do for you?
Yeah. And actually, it took him through the steps, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Ed's the guy that took him through the steps. So here's the guy that wrote the steps, but he had a non-alcoholic take him through the steps. I think Ed Dowling would have been the guy for him. If you had to put a gun to my head and say who it is, it's Ed Dowling. But Ebby dies with like 4 or 5 years sober, not long-term sobriety like we think about, you know, when we think about long-term sobriety. But that's the best Ebby could do, but he couldn't do it until he went to Texas. So.
Yeah. And he met Cersei. You haven't, his character done. Yep. If you haven't met Cersei, so this personality spread all throughout our history that carried major principles to people to help them get sober.
Do you think there should be any changes to the first 164 pages of the big book of AA? Well, I would say no. I don't think so. But, No. Right? But it's happening. They're coming out with this new translation of the book in plain English, right? And they're going to change the steps. Going to change the language. They're going to change the wording of the steps. I mean, I'm just telling you, I'm reporting. Don't shoot the messenger here. They're doing that. Right? Go ahead.
But they're not changing this book.
No, they're not changing this
book. It's an addendum. It's an addition.
It's a translation.
It's a translation. And it was really, I think, I was ambivalent about this, and I went to a, it was called a symposium. I don't even really know how to spell that word, but it was a symposium, and it was a bunch of AA speakers in a very mixed group of people, and the Myers and Chris were there, and you know, Myers and Chris are really, really
fundamentalists.
Yeah, they're, you know, and wonderful message, and there was a woman there, I think she was lesbian, I don't know, she was from San Francisco, and we were in a little group, and I was with Myers, Chris wasn't with us, and he was like, why do we need this? And she explained to him, she says, you have to understand that people that I hang around with will not, she didn't say cannot, she said will not read that book because they don't get what you get out of it. And you could see Myers going, what? He said, what we need is just the translation so we can get that same message that you're getting out of that book and give it to people that will get that message and take it to other people. And Myers was like, oh, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but he goes, I think we need to do it.
And he's the most fundamentalist, black belt.
It was like,
no change, nothing,
wow,
ever.
Wow. So it's that's why I was talking about earlier. Sometimes you have to listen to the minority, because the minority is actually trying to tell us, I need help with what you got. And I don't know, you know, but it's like, especially the guys in prison, you know, they cannot read. They cannot. And you know, if you gotta look at it and say, wow, we carry the message to these poor guys, but then can you imagine if you gave them a book that they could read, and then they could go to the guy down the three cells down and go, hey, I got something, I got a solution to my seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Let's read this together. Can you imagine if that was just done without us? But we have to. So I don't. It's really. I think it's really. This is where that willingness, that honesty and that open-mindedness has to come into play. It's you know, if I can't turn, we were talking about this earlier, I never turn anybody away from AA. Sometimes they have to turn them towards a solution that will help them with their seemingly hopeless state of mind and body.
Yeah, and I'm just going to be honest with you. I don't see my belief is that you just need somebody to sit down with you this book.
Yeah.
And then the argument always, well, if they're in prison, you can't go sit down with them and read it. You don't have that opportunity to read it. And so I can hear that point of view. Here's my concern about that, is that you get sober on something else and you bring it to an AA meeting and you start talking about that book that nobody has any idea what you're talking about. Yes, there becomes the problem that I see it. But wasn't that true when we let treatment centers come here?
Yeah.
They started bringing their version of the fourth step into AA meetings, you know. Treatment centers back in the 70s, when treatment centers started coming out, and what did AA do? They just opened up their arms and they said, welcome in. And they just had one bus. Treatment centers had one bus. They brought everybody to AA. We welcomed them here. We've been complaining about it ever since, right? That's how we roll. We said welcome, and then we complained about it. So I'm a guy that believes, hey, look, I don't think we need to tinker, but it's a foregone conclusion. And the position I've come to give peace to myself is that I can't control what GSO does. Mm. If I've got the book and a guy in front of me, that's all I need to be concerned about. I don't need to be concerned about, because I can get, my magnifying mind can just expound itself, and I don't need to be concerned. What they do at GSO has no concern to me. My concern is who about the guy in front of me.
Am I working with that guy? And my guys come to me and say, oh, my gosh, they're changing the steps, changing the mirror. I say, that's none of our business. Our business is, that's some people they elect. Our business is to work with the guy in front of me. That's all my business is. So if I'm working with this guy right here, and as long as I've got access to this book, that's all I care about. I need to be, because if I start caring about all that, I get convoluted, and I take my eye off where? The moment. And I'm supposed to be in the moment. And if I'm in the moment, just working for this guy right here. How many people do you sponsor? About half of them. But the truth is, the guy I'm working with, one, I sponsor one, whoever's in front of me, whoever I'm talking to, that's who I'm sponsoring. If I'm talking to this guy, I'm not really sponsoring the other guy right now. I'm sponsoring this one. That's the one. So, anyway, that's my thoughts.
Yeah, we'll see how it turns out. We don't know.
10 or 11, review your day. It's 11. Next question. It's in the book. It's 11. It's a short answer. Go ahead. I mean, that was so easy. I didn't have to ask that.
Oh, this is a long one. I want to get to a place where I can ask my God to surprise me and be confident enough in Him that I can handle that. How do I get there?
Oh, man, that's good.
That's a wonderful question. So what's a surprise? You know, how do I get there? Wow, that's...
The present.
All I can talk about is I had an experience. I don't like birthdays. I don't like to be surprised. I don't like any of that stuff, you know. But I remember when I turned 50, I was at my meeting with Jason, and he says, boy, you're going to have your 50th birthday coming up. I said, yeah. He goes, we should have a party for you. I don't like parties. The only way I'll do it is if you surprise me. He said, okay. I turned 50. And every time I went to a meeting, I knew this was going to be the party. Every time I got a phone call, I knew they were going to surprise me. It never happened.
You're disappointed?
It never happened. And about 2 years later, Jason said to me, are you mad at me for something? I go, no, I'm not mad at you. And he goes, well, you seem to treat me a little different. I said, well, do you remember when you were going to surprise me? With what? When I turned 50? Oh, my God, I forgot all about that. Yeah, I know.
Selfish bastard.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know. How do you, the surprise, what, ask my God to, can your God, see, that's, when I look at the fundamental idea of God is deep down inside of me, it's covered up by pomp and circumstance. If I uncover that pomp, that circumstance of worship of other things, I'm in a surprise state. I'm in everything. Everything is absolutely brand new. Everything, you know, and like literally, when you, that term "stop and smell the roses." Everybody has always said that to us. But I'll tell you what. I was sponsoring a guy who started a huge church in L.A. It was a religious science church, and he was really involved in this. And I sponsored him, so I was intimidated by the fact that he was a really spiritual giant. And he was a whack job. He was a whack job. And I'm not going to tell you some of the stuff he did. But he called me up one day, and he said, "I'm in trouble." I said, meet me at the coffee shop. We'll talk about it. He met me at the coffee shop. I'm in trouble. I said, get in the car. We'll go down to the Balboa Park. And we get in the car, and he goes, I'm in trouble. We get down to Balboa Park, and he goes, I'm in trouble. And I go, let's go over to the Rose Garden. And he says, but I'm in trouble. I said, let's go over to the Rose Garden. I go over to the Rose Garden. I'm like, God, I don't know what to do with this whack job. I have no idea what to do. And he goes, I'm in trouble. What are we going to do? And I go, you see that rose over there? Let's go over there and smell that. And tell me what it smells like. And he went over there and he stuck his nose. He goes, I said, take a diaphragmic smell. Just get it down into your soul. And he said, oh, my God, it smells like. And I can't remember what he said. And I went, wow. And I said, go over to that other rose over there and tell me what that smells like. And he took this big diaphragmic smell. And he described it. And I went, you're kidding. And he got, go get that other. And he did it. And he did it again. And, the two of us, I stood up and I started smelling these roses. And there was like a profound, beautiful moment. It was a scent. It was like, oh my God. And it was a surprise to me. I didn't know that stop and smell the roses was more than just a metaphor. It was an action. The joy of living is our code, but action is the key word. I cannot walk into a supermarket or a store that has a basket full of roses without sticking my schnoz right in that thing and going, oh. And it just changes my whole attitude and outlook upon everything and everyone. That is a surprise. If I sit in the meeting with my arms unfolded and I listen to what's being said, I'm surprised by some of the messages I'm hearing. If I'm sitting in the meeting with my phone in my pocket, or if I'm listening to something else, if I'm watching something, I don't hear the surprise. I can only be surprised in that moment. Mm. And that's how I get there. And it's really, it's when I joke about it, being in the moment. It is one of the most awesomest experiences I can ever have. And it always is a surprise. When you were talking about Charlie, you know Charlie's going to say the same thing. And I did that to my sponsor, and he would come back with this response. He says, "But you haven't heard what Charlie has talked about today." And that changes everything. And I would sit in meetings, and I go, "My God, I can't." I would sit there with my sponsor. I go, "My God, this speaker is awful, awful, awful." And he would get me outside. He said, "I don't want to ever hear you say that again." I said, "But," he goes, "I know they're not the best, some of these people. But if you turn that statement, 'this speaker is awful,' to 'this is the best speaker I heard today,' you're going to say the same thing, but without the vitriolic toxicity. This is the best speaker I say today." And I say that sometimes when I'm talking. And you know these boobs that come up in the line, and they go, "Thank you, Joe. You're the best speaker I've heard today." And we're out of here.
Or how about this? "Thank you for your service," right? "Thank you for your service." I love that. Yeah. Oh, how do you approach a loved one about their alcohol abuse? Ooh, this is good. I don't. Yeah. I don't. You know why? Because they're never going to hear from me.
Yeah.
They're never going to hear from me. I'll tell you this story. So I have a daughter. She'll be 34 in April. I haven't seen her or talked to her in 7 years. She, 10 years ago, I got a phone call from her. She called Lori first, looking for me. She called me, I wouldn't answer. She called Lori. She had come home from college. She went to school in New York at Marymount. And she came home. I didn't see her when she came home, but for like a year I didn't see her. And I came home. I was working with a guy, so I came home, and Lori said, "Rachel's trying to get hold of you. You need to call her." And so I called her. She'd been living in her car for a year. I called her. I said, "What's going on?" She said, "I can't stop drinking. I can't stop eating pills." And I said, "What you guys taught me. Honey, I can't help you. But there's a lady who can help you, and I'm going to give you her number. I want you to call her." And she called that lady, and that lady got her into detox. And she got sober, and she started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she met Mr. Wonderful and gifts of the program. I had a granddaughter about 9 months later. And about a year after that, she came to me one day. She said, "I don't think I'm an alcoholic." I said, "I can't tell you whether you are or not. I don't know that. Only you can figure that out." I said, "But I will say this to you. If you go back to the way it was, if you go back to drinking again and doing what you're doing, I'm coming after the little girl. You just need to know that." "Sure, are you threatening me?" I said, "I'm not threatening you. You were living in your car, for God's sakes. You want your daughter living in a car?" "No, I don't want that." "Okay, I'm just telling you." She worked for me at the time, and I found out she ripped me off for about 80 grand and fired her. And she had been buying drugs through Facebook Messenger, and she left her Facebook open. And so I got in, and I printed off all the drug deals that she had been making. And I had to do a forensic audit. That's how I found out she stole all this money. And I went to the father of my granddaughter, who's sober now 11 years. I went to him, and my wife had maintained contact with him. And a relationship with him, and said, "My daughter's drinking, use it again. You need to go get your daughter, and here's all the evidence. So just take that and go." My daughter couldn't pass a drug test, and she lost custody of that little girl. And I see that little girl all the time. I was with her Thursday night, her and her little brother, who's not even my grandson, but he's my grandson, you know, because it's her brother. And her dad married a gal that got sober, that I watched get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's 7-8 years sober now.
they have a child together, and we go out to eat sometime, and people say, "Is that your daughter?" And it just takes too long to explain, so I just say, "Yes, that's my daughter." Right? Because I don't know where we get this idea that blood makes us family. I don't know where we get that idea. And so I haven't seen my daughter in 7 years. And Christmases, birthdays, Father's Day. Those are hard, Joe. But if I get in the, my alcoholism almost killed me. If I get in the ring with her, it'll take me out. Her alcoholism will kill me, and I know that today. I can't get in the ring with her. Can't get in the ring with her alcoholism. It'll kill me. So when you ask a question, what if a family, I immediately turned no. Say, you need to go get somebody else to talk to them. You can't help them. They'll never hear it from you. And if they hear it from you, they'll resent you later. It's just been my experience. And so these are hard. I mean, here's the reality. I remember when all that happened to me, when all that went down, I thought, I got on my knees to God and say, this is it. You mean this is me? Mr. Alcoholics Anonymous, this is what happens to me. We're an AA family. I got a wife that's in Al-Anon, and we're doing all this stuff. And this is what happens to me? Of course it is. Why me? Why not me? Why not me? There's nothing special about me. There's nothing. I'm not immune from life. I'm not immune from what happens. None of us are. Why not me? But I can tell you this, because of that story, there have been people that sat across from Lori and I when they say, I just don't know how this or that and the other and the third. And we say, well, I can. They say, well, you just don't understand. I say, oh. But I haven't talked to my daughter in 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, whatever it is. Oh, I do understand. I get it. I'm not telling you it's easy. I'm telling you, with God, all things are possible. I hold out hope that for that one day that phone will ring and she's ready to talk to me and make an amends. Her mother has tried to reach out to me and say, isn't it time we get the family healed? And I'm like going, I don't know what I need to do here. I'm open. I'm ready. If all they got to do is come to me, and I'm ready to listen. I'm ready to talk. It's not about the money. It's not about that. What I know, the transformational process is coming and owning my mistake. And if I just say, oh, it's all okay, that's not the deal. I know that's not the deal. There has to be a transformational process on her part. You know, I can forgive. I'm ready to forgive, have forgiven. It's not about the money. But it's about the act of contrition, the act that here's my mistake. I was wrong. So when we talk about families, difficult, hard, extraordinarily difficult if it's a child. You know, wife, husband, you know, children are hard. They're really hard. And it takes a lot of faith. And it takes a lot of work. And you might have to go to Al-Anon, seriously, right? Those, I mean, you may be that bad. It's so drastic that you have to go to Al-Anon. Sometimes it gets that bad. But with God, all things are possible. So.
And I don't have any experience with that, but I hope whoever asked that question could see how his experience can benefit what you're going through, if you're going through something. And I could have all sorts of opinions about this stuff, but I don't have the experience.
Yes, I still buy OxyClean. It works. I mean, my God. Why wouldn't you buy that?
Please elaborate on hitting walls in AA, particularly 7 to 10 years of sobriety. Ooh. Whoa, there you go. Great question. Great, great question. And I don't think we talk about it enough, and that is. Elaborate. All I can do is talk about my experience when I was newly sober. Somebody gave me a CD of Tom Brady Jr., who was from North Carolina, talking about emotional sobriety. He did a talk in 1992. I forget what it was. That making a difference. But I have listened to that CD probably 4 or 5 times a year for 33 years, and I give it to people all the time. He's talking about his experience with that topic, Next Frontier Emotional Sobriety, but it is, he talks about that. He talks about the 5-year menopause. That's what he calls it. Every 5 years, that's when people go, is this it? Is this it? You know, he talks about the difference between sobriety and inebriety. You know, we're in the fellowship of AA, but we're not into that carrying the message to other people. It and sometimes it's so much easier to focus on anger and resentment than it is on recovery and healing, you know. And it's a tremendous, because it happens that every 5 years there's a new and it's, we talked earlier about, it's this awakening, it's this awareness, it's really this constant search for self. You know, we suffer from selfishness and self-centeredness, but we're constantly searching, we're uncovering, we're discovering, we're discarding these things that are blocking me from having a relationship with you first, and then through you I find this power that's greater than myself. That's what happens. It's just like that whole, is this it? Now you've gone from a spiritual solution to a material solution. I haven't got the job yet. I haven't got the girl yet. I haven't got the boy yet. I haven't got the car. I haven't got all this stuff. That's because you're comparing your insides to everybody else's outsides. I did it for a long time. Oh my God, how come they're making all that kind of money? And it's like, if your life is based on an economic number, you'll never, ever be satisfied. Ever. Nothing will work for you. Nothing will work. But if your life is based on that, just that gratitude, your whole attitude is like, wow, how can I be like this? And it's just, most of the people you know, I know, some people have loads of dough, and they're absolutely miserable. And then some people have absolutely nothing, and their car is full. They got newcomers that are hanging out the window trying to get into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, and the guys that pull up in the big fancy cars, and, oh, don't get near me, please. This is brand new, and I go home. So that's seven. It happens all the time, you know. It happens. My friend Joan is going to be celebrating 67 years of sobriety on June 15th. She's 90. She'll be 92, I think, in 2 weeks. And Zoom saved her life. Saved her life because she was able to log on anywhere in the world. And then at that point she says, I need to get back. I need to feel the fellowship that I crave. You know, and she is just we're doing a little workshop in May, just a 1-day workshop. And she called me, she says, Michaeline's gonna take me to the group. I'm so happy.
Is this June G?
No, Joan.
Joan. Okay, Joan.
And June G's part of it as well.
Yeah.
But it's just this, and that it's in that giving. It's not in the getting, because I think when you're looking for that, then you become possessive of it and you don't want to let it go. But boy, when I was talking to Cliff about this, people come up to you and go, how did you get what you have? We don't have time to talk about that. But you can go, hey, have you tried this? And I usually say, do you like to read? Some people don't. Well, do you like to listen? Sure. So now look at all the tools we have. We can go to this YouTube, or go to this podcast, go to this book. You know, there's so many more tools to give people what we have. And that's that. Because when somebody is like going, is this it? You go back to the prospector. There's a vein. There's a vein of a preciousness that's inside this tunnel of concrete and lock it up. That's what the wall is. You haven't put it there. I put that wall up. It slowly starts coming up, and that wall is spelled E-G-O. And that wall can get really, really thick, you know, and that's why your sponsor, you know, it's like your sponsor has the wrench that fits the nut in the top of your head. You know, it's like, and he might have to back it off a little bit. He might have to tighten it up. Those are all simple little tools. But when you think about it, what do you call me, a nut? No. You've got. It's just your sponsor has. You've set up this intimacy, this level. When you walk into a meeting, he goes, "What's wrong?" Nothing's wrong. Oh. Come here. You know. And all of a sudden, you get down to causes and conditions like that.
AA has a wrench to fit every nut.
Yeah.
Whiskey's got a paddle to fit every ass. Right?
Dr. Bob is credited with you must give it away to keep it. My experience is I had nothing until I gave it away.
I agree.
Yeah.
That's the great paradigm. We talked about that. You know, I don't have it till I give it away. You're going to prosper.
I think I've got something. I get electrified. I get this spiritual experience. I get lit up. We talk about it all the time. The lights come on in people's eyes. We see it behind their eyes. The lights come on and so they get on fire. I would rather have ignorance on fire than knowledge on ice. Let me say that again. I'd rather have ignorance on fire than knowledge on ice. Get somebody on fire, they're just 12 stomping everybody, right? They're just out saving the world. That's good. We can work with that. But if I've got all this knowledge and I just go home and sit and I don't share it, I'm in bad shape, right?
Yeah.
And I'm denying all that stuff. I'm going to be to that person that says, I don't even know why I have to go anymore because I've become stale. I mean, it's just frozen. It's on ice. It's no good. It's no good to anybody if I'm not giving it away. The very essence of this is to give it away to keep it. I mean, I can't grasp hold of it. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't make any sense in the sense of what we know in the material world. But you've got to remember, for now we've entered the world of the Spirit. We're talking about a different playing field. When we were talking a while ago, is you can't use the measuring stick that I used in this material world in the spiritual world. You can't have an economic number because it doesn't work here. I can't have a number. There's a book by a great Greek philosopher named Seneca, an old, old book, and it talks about the shortness of life. And it's like an 88-page book, and it's about how we waste time trying to get somewhere to have time. Right? When I retire, when I get to here, and we miss all this.
Yeah.
And we talk about when I get to that point, then and we just chew time away. The time to do anything is now.
Yeah.
Not when I hit retirement, not when she starts acting better, not when the kids do. Now. It's in the now. It's in the moment. That's what the spiritual world is all about. I can't use these measuring sticks. Those are old ideas I'm bringing in. And you get frustrated because why won't this work? It doesn't work here. It doesn't work in this world.
That's such a great question. You just got me going here because I went right to this. So anyway, it's two stories I'm going to tell. You know, my sponsor always says, you know, like there's two major things in our life that we concentrate on. We concentrate on our birthday, and then we think about the day we're going to die. And he says that when you look at your headstone, it's going to have the year you were born. Then there's a little line in the middle, and there's the day you die. And he goes, that little line is called a dash. We focus on the year we're born, we focus on the day we died, but we forget about the dash. We forget about living in that dash, and that's what that moment is. I started sponsoring this kid that came off the street. He was a college professor, and he ended up in the streets. He ended up in prison. He's of Japanese descent, and he's Buddhist. And we started reading We Agnostics. I remember at the house, and he goes, "Oh, I hate this chapter." I go, "Why?" He said, "For that one line, God either is or he isn't was a choice to be." And I went, this is where I think you can see how your experience can benefit others. And I read a lot of spiritual across the board. I haven't got into the Quran yet, but my good friend reads, he's Persian, he reads the Quran. And so I took Alcoholics Anonymous literature and I said, okay, let me just read this slowly, this paragraph, and see if this makes a difference to you. So I said, when we become alcoholics crushed by a self-imposed crisis, we could not postpone or evade. We had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or he is, or else he is nothing, period. And that's the way I read it to him. And I said, let me reread that last paragraph. God is everything or he is no thing. And his head literally went, poof, because I knew the phrase no thing is a Buddhist phrase. And he went, oh my God, I never looked at it that way.
No thing.
It is, he goes, God is, to me, is no thing. But in the book, it says nothing. And when he went, wow, that's my belief, is that God is no thing. And he goes, this is a wonderful chapter. It's like, phew, gotcha, you know? And but that's all about the experience. It's all about the ability to listen for the nugget. And I hope you guys do that. And that's the whole thing about giving it away. It doesn't have to be this. It doesn't have to be this material thing. It's this. Wow. You might save somebody's life just by changing a word and just
putting a dash in it. Yeah. No thing.
Yeah. I went to a funeral this week. You made me think of this. I went to a funeral this week of a lawyer who's a longtime lawyer in the city. She was, and we had no clue about this. And she was kind of gruff. I mean, she was, so I should have suspected, right? But she was always good to me. I mean, she was always really nice to me. But anyway, she went to the hospital because she was having stomach problems, and she'd been drinking so much she had an ulcer in her stomach. She checked herself out AMA because she was shaking so hard she had to get home and drink. 2 days later, she died. Nobody knew. Nobody knew. Quiet desperation. So we go to this. So I go to the funeral because you know what? You people told me. We show up. We show up. And from the time the family walked in till the time the minister excused us, 15 minutes. You guys been to AA funerals? Oh. Hour and a half. If we're lucky.
If you're lucky.
If
yeah,
you're lucky,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Or it's a full.
Does anybody have anything to say? 17 people line up, right? They got lots to say here. Said that. Does anybody have anything to say? Nobody moved. And I'm thinking, I'm just watching this, and I was aware of the sadness that descended on me.
Yeah.
The dash, the life, this life of quiet desperation she lived, nobody knew. Her husband had died about 10 years ago, and she just buried herself in a bottle in the evenings. Nobody knew. Nobody knew. And I just thought, I have this profound sadness. And, you know, I'm able to do that today. I have compassion for just people today. I have, you know, my wife used to see something on TV that, hey, they've had this flood in Nepal and 30,000 people are dying. And I go, okay, what's for dinner? I can't hook into that. But I'm not in Nepal. I'm here. I don't identify with 30,000 people wiped out. That's no impact on me. But today, when that happens, I'm like, oh my God, 30,000 people died.
Think about it.
Yes, I have that ability to. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. These are spiritual experiences. That's a spiritual experience. If you can feel for that, that's a spiritual experience. Because I'm a guy that has walls around me. I'm in touch with that. I'm in touch with humanity. I'm a part of that race. 30,000 people get wiped out. That's a big deal. But I used to be like, that doesn't have anything to do with me. Well, why do I care? That kind of deal. All right. Karnak.
We got like three or four more. We'll finish it up. It says, Bob. So I should probably see Joe. It said, Bob, what was that fourth thing you said?
Jesus.
Was that you?
So here we go. I am grateful. I have no problem expressing gratitude or dishing it out. However, I really struggle with accepting gratitude. Any thoughts? So I think they're saying I have a hard time when people are nice to me. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time accepting when people say good things. I think that's what they mean. Because we talked about that earlier. Like when you guys get up to applaud, that's hard to take. It is. At first, it's hard to take.
It used to be.
Well, yeah, it used to be.
No, you guys could go a lot longer.
The first
2 hours. They could go a lot longer.
Just stand up any time and do that. That's good. But I think that's the condition we live in, right? I give it a condition. I'm not worthy of that.
Yeah.
I'm not good enough for you to tell me thank you. I'm not good enough for you to say. That's old ideas. Well, I'm still plagued with old ideas. If I'm having trouble. See, what my sponsors used to tell me, you know, when somebody comes and said, Joe, what a great talk, man, that was really great. Man, I really love what you had to say. And the first thing I'm saying, oh, man, I appreciate that, but, you know, anybody could come here and do that. And what I'm supposed to say is, thank you.
Yeah. That's compassion.
That's compassion, but it's also being willing to accept what they're given. So if I start deflecting the gift, I'm giving it back to the giver. If I start making excuses of why I'm not worthy of that gift, you're telling the giver, I'm not worth that. Don't do that for me. And if you know how much gratitude, the person who wrote this, how much gratitude you do when you do something for somebody, why you deny people doing that for you? You're denying them the gift. Right? When I do something good for somebody, I get that feeling. We get it, right? We chase it. We love that. That's part of why we're here. The giving, the part of it. Why would we deny somebody else that same feeling? Why would we deny somebody else the ability to have that same experience of giving us something, whether it's a compliment, a ride, or whatever? Hard for us. Hard for us to accept that we're worthy to have that. Right? But that's a problem. We're all God's kids here. Everybody. Book talks about it. Shoulder to shoulder. No worse, no better. Nobody in this room today, not any better, not any worse, no matter what your mind tells you right now, right? No better, no worse. We're all the same. And so if we're all the same, then I'm worthy. God doesn't have any stepkids. We're all part of, right? I love what my wife says about God. She says, you know, I'm one person. When I go home, my kids call me Mom. My friends call me Lori. My granddaughter calls me Lolly. My husband calls me Sweetheart. I have a lot of different names, but I'm just one me. And she said, I kind of think that's how God is. You know, we have a lot of different names for God, but I just think there's just one God. And however our path is to get there and whatever we call that, that's okay. That's perfectly okay. And because we just have that one, it's because we're sober under that one God, then we're part of that universe. We're part of his kids, and we're all worthy. Got 30 seconds.
Joe and Cliff, you both spoke Friday about the love in AA. Can you please share something about love, either a story or your concept of, or even what you learned here? Wow. When you were talking, I was thinking about my own story of love. It's that, you know, it was when I was diagnosed with AIDS, it was like it was the love of the fellowship. But then about 5 or 6 years ago, my heart blew out, and I ended up in the hospital in the emergency room, and then I was in the hospital for 5 or 6 days, and they were trying to get me back, and they had to paddle me a couple times, and it was a rough going. And when they paddled me, they actually fractured my spine, and I had some severe pain. But what it was when we were talking about the I'm in not intensive care. I was in the in a private room in AA. They find us. They find us. You know, that's why I always say my name. You know, it's like you know, everybody knew Joe Conroy. They're not going to go to the hospital and go, I'm looking for the guy with the Boston accent. Yeah, who's that? You know. But what happened was I was in this room and I was wired to all these machines, and every time somebody would come in the room, and there was a lot of people in the room, these machines, the nurses, the monitoring station was on the other floor, so they had to call down to the nurses station and go, there's something wrong, his numbers, his counts are going up, boom, 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 and they would come in and everybody would go, wow, what's up with all these machines, you know, and my heart was like, bum, 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 and they come running in, they go, oh my God, we can't have all these people in the room. The nurses were like, we have to put signs up, you can't come in, you have to ask us. And I go, you're not going to be able to keep these whack jobs out of this room, trust me, it's not going to happen, you know, and I can't do anything about it. And then the doctor came in, the conductor, the leader came in, and I said, the nurses are really upset with me because all these people in the room. He said, Joe, I wish every one of my patients had a room full of people that had love, because you're going to be out of here a lot quicker than everybody else. I'm like, wow, you're kidding me. And it's so we talked about taking the action and putting the love into your life. It's going to come back tenfold. These people were like, I would wake up in the morning and these, how you doing? Oh, get away from me. You know, it's like, I'm like, wow. It's like, and I go, this is what they needed to do. And what I needed to do was just say, thanks for coming, man. You're saving my life. I didn't need to say, you know, the friggin' machines are going off, you need to stay out of here. And I just would say, thank you.
When my dad died when I was 5 years sober. My mom died when I was like 14 years sober. And at my dad's funeral, there was like 15 people from Alcoholics Anonymous that drove down to his funeral. And it's like a 3-hour drive to get there. And they just came. And then when my mom died, there was like 40 people, because the fellowship had grown up around me. Right? And so I had all the, and my niece, I remember my niece came up to me, and I'm standing with some of the guys that I sponsor, some of my friends, and she came up and she said, you know, if I just had 3 friends like my uncle has, and it just, the impact of that stuff, her statement hit me of, my God, these people really just care about me. You know, they just care about me. With not even done anything, I didn't do anything extraordinary. They just love me because they just love me. And to recognize and just realize, to kind of just sink in that, look, these people just love me just because they're not, they're driving, they drive 3 hours to a woman they never met. Not for her. They came for me. Right? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
They showed up just because. And when you kind of, when, because I'm not a guy that knows how to accept that. That's foreign to me because I built so many shields around me. But I got that day when she said that, I kind of got some realization that I'm okay. And you know, suddenly I'm an orphan in AA. I'm 50, but I'm now an orphan in AA. And I thought, I'm okay. I'm going to be all right. So my sponsor says that Ebby's promise to both, to Bill, trump any and all other promises in the book. Do you agree? Here's the promise that Ebby makes to Bill. My friend promised when these things were done. And so you got to realize he's taken Ebby, Bill's gone through the steps. If you read the book, he's gone through the steps. And he says, my friend promised me when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answers all my problems. I don't think it trumps all the promises in the book. I think that is all the promises in the book. I think that statement encapsulates everything we've talked about here. I think it encapsulates all. When I do these things, I'll have the elements of a new way of life because I will now rely on God. And if I'm relying on God, where am I? I'm in the moment. And if I'm relying on God, all those other promises have come true for me. Those foo-foo promises and the non-drinking promises and all the other promises laid out in the book. That Bill's statement, what Ebby says to him, encapsulates all of those into one. You think?
Mic drop.
Mind blowing.
Thank
you, guys.
That's
it.